Dana Carvey and David Spade here.
You might know our podcast, Fly on the Wall, featuring guests from across the entertainment industry.
We decided to do a spinoff called Superfly, and it's fun. It's just two of us riffing on current events, pop culture, catching up, impressions.
Joe, Trump's trying to be a dictator. Yeah, she says, bump on the tater tots. Joe, no.
Listen to and follow Superfly on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcast.
You're listening to Comedy Central.
Coming to you from New York City, the only city in America, it's The Daily Show. Tonight, we are hearing crazy shit. Rudy takes a hit. And Mayor Eric Adams. This is The Daily Show with Trevor Noah.
Show, everybody. We've got a great one for you tonight. Take a seat. Let's get into it. The January 6th committee dropped bombshells today. Rudy Giuliani is lucky to be alive. And our guest tonight is the mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, and he's going to be joining us on the show. And I'm going to ask him if he'll finally let me drive a subway car. Yeah! So let's do this, people. Let's jump straight into today's headlines. You know, there are a lot of depressing things going on in America right now. So we decided, let's start off today's show with some good news. And I'm talking about what happened to Rudy Giuliani. Former New York City mayor and America's most illegal lawyer. You see, he was in a supermarket on Staten Island Sunday, campaigning for his son, Andrew Giuliani, who's trying to make history as New York's first caveman governor. And thankfully, Rudy is now doing okay after just barely surviving a heinous drive-by on his upper back.
A Staten Island grocery store worker is facing assault charges, accused of slapping former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani. This surveillance video shows the encounter inside a ShopRite store. The worker appears to hit Giuliani on the back, prompting a reaction from the former mayor.
NYPD has said that this man was a 39-year-old suspect who approached Giuliani, slapped him in the back, and said, "What's up, scumbag?" Giuliani refused medical attention at the scene, and the 39-year-old was taken into custody with the NYPD recommending charges of second-degree assault.
Don't you laugh! Don't you dare laugh! This is second-degree assault! That's how tough New York's laws are. Third degree is if you lightly blow on someone's ear. And first degree is if you boop them on the nose. Boop! I've been hit! I've been hit! Please, don't get me wrong. I don't think it is right for anyone to be putting their hands on politicians, or anyone for that matter, without their consent, right? I'm not saying that. But no way in hell is that second-degree assault. Like, I barely tell, that's not second-degree. If that's assault, then what? I guess Will Smith murdered Chris Rock. That's what happened there. And now I'm in the grave. In the grave. And I love how they say, Rudy declined medical attention. Medical attention for what? For what? That's the kind of injury where the only thing you could do is kiss it and make it feel better. That's it. Is it better, Rudy? Is it better? In fact, if anyone needs medical attention here, it's the guy who touched Rudy Giuliani. Yeah, that dude's hand probably looks like Dumbledore's after he barehanded a Horcrux. And yes, I will admit, this guy did sound aggressive, but you've got to understand, what's up, scumbag, is just how people say hello on Staten Island, you know? Yeah, it's a normal conversation. What's up, scumbag? Nothing much, f*** your mother. All right, well, nice to see you, grandma. But to me, the best part of this story is that the more Rudy told it, the more the slap seemed to hurt.
He hit me hard enough to knock me forward about like that. You know elderly people die mostly from falls? This guy could have killed me.
I got hit on the back as if a boulder hit me. It knocked me forward a step or two.
All of a sudden, I feel a shot on my back. like somebody shot me.
You know, that was the woman who was rubbing my back. The guy hit me so hard that she herself almost fell from the reverberation of it.
Yeah, that's right. He slapped me so hard my eyeballs fell out, and I had to pick them up and put them back in. You all saw it. You saw he slapped me so hard I shit out the side of my face 2 years ago. Yeah, that's how hard it was. You saw it, everybody. I felt it. You know,
I thought that Rudy was lying about the election being stolen because he was a Trump sycophant. It turns out he just lives in another world. This is just his brain. And I will say, in his defense, he was already in a weakened state. You know, you have to acknowledge that. He was out during the day in a store that sells garlic. I mean, you know, it was hard for him. It was hard. But let's move on from an attack that Rudy will always remember to one that he always conveniently seems to forget. January 6th. The day Trump supporters tried to play capture the flag with Mike Pence's head. Yesterday, the January 6th committee announced that they would be holding a surprise hearing with a surprise witness. And you know, whenever Congress says something like, oh, this is a must watch, you're like, ah, that's what they said about Morbius. But let me tell you, people, today's hearing was insane. I'm talking like proper insane. So let's catch up on all the latest January 6th updates. It turns out the surprise witness today was Cassidy Hutchinson, a top aide to Donald Trump's chief of staff, which means she was often in the room where it happens, the room where it happens. The it was overthrowing democracy. Now, Hutchinson had a lot of firsthand knowledge of what Trump was doing from the moment that he lost the election all the way through January 6th. And one of the stories she told was how Trump lost his shit when he found out his attorney general wasn't going along with his lies about the election.
I remember hearing noise coming from down the hallway. I left the office and went down to the dining room, and I noticed that the door was propped open and the valet was inside the dining room changing the tablecloth off of the dining room table. He motioned for me to come in and then pointed towards the front of the room near the fireplace mantel and the TV, where I first noticed there was ketchup dripping down the wall and there's a shattered porcelain plate on the floor. The valet had articulated that the president was extremely angry at the attorney general's AP interview and had thrown his lunch against the wall.
And Ms. Hutchinson, was this the only instance that you are aware of where the president threw dishes?
It's not.
And are there other instances in the dining room that you recall where he expressed his anger?
There were several times throughout my tenure with the chief of staff that I was aware of him either throwing dishes or flipping the tablecloth to let all the contents of the table go onto the floor.
Yeah, I know. I too was shocked to hear that Trump threw any of his food away. Because, I mean, let's be honest, this guy has taken more selfies with food than he has with some of his kids, right? It's probably the reason Eric dresses up as a hot dog just to get a hug. Do you love me now, Dad? Do you love me?
You're the son I always wanted, Oscar Mayer. Always wanted.
And you heard what she said. This wasn't a one-time thing. Trump was constantly throwing food tantrums. But what's interesting is she didn't say flipping the table. She said flipping the table cloth. So either Trump was an amateur magician he wasn't strong enough to flip a table. So he just did the table cloth instead. He was like, And you know, if this happened regularly, it must have sucked for all the people who work in the White House. You know, all the staff who have to clean up after him, the people who made the food and the dishes. Can you imagine how traumatizing this must have been for the dishes?
Everybody, welcome to the White House. Be our guest. Be our guest. Oh, what is happening? Ah, you just killed Mrs. Potts. Ah, sheep don't look now. Your mother has been pieces. She has been murdered. Oh, my God. This man is worse than the beast. We should go back. At least the beast didn't try to have sex with the feather duster. Ah! Ah!
That one went straight to DVD. Now, it turns out that wasn't the only Trump tantrum that Hutchinson testified about, because she also said that on January 6th, as the Trump mob was marching towards the Capitol, Trump wanted to lead them to the Capitol himself, right? But when Secret Service agent Bobby Engel refused the president's request for safety, this happened.
The president said something to the effect of, "I'm the effing president, take me up to the Capitol now." To which Bobby responded, "Sir, we have to go back to the West Wing." The president reached up towards the front of the vehicle to grab at the steering wheel. Mr. Engel grabbed his arm, said, "Sir, you need to take your hand off the steering wheel. We're going back to the West Wing. We're not going to the Capitol." Mr. Trump then used his free hand to lunge towards Bobby Engel. And when Mr. Renato had recounted this story to me, he had motioned towards his clavicles.
God damn, that is insane. Trump fighting to take control of the president's car like he's a bad guy in an action movie, only he's the president and this is real life? I mean, you gotta admit, though, fighting your own Secret Service agent is kind of genius on Trump's part, right? No, because he's hitting the one person who can't hit back. Yeah, I mean, they can punch back, but then they've gotta jump in front of their own punch, you know? Just like, take that, no!
Did you feel that one, Rudy?
But you know, this whole thing shows you how lazy Trump is. The Capitol is like 2 miles away. Everyone else walked there. But Trump was like, okay, I could walk there, I could walk. Or I could try steal a car from the Secret Service. Which one is it? And not to victim blame, but this is on the Secret Service, right? You had 4 years to Trump-proof that vehicle. You knew who you were dealing with. There should have been a toy steering wheel in the passenger seat the whole time. Just let him think he's driving and go back to the West Wing anyways. And you know, beyond Trump, this story just proves once and for all that sitting in the backseat is always a position of weakness. It doesn't matter what the real power dynamics are. No one in the backseat gets their way. Because, I mean, he's lunging at them like, "I'm the f***ing president!" And they're like, "You're in the backseat, bitch, shut up!" He's like, "Mwah. Well, I'm gonna put my window down." So, there were many funny and disturbing moments in today's testimony, but the most damning part of today was when Hutchinson revealed that when President Trump was told that some of the mob had weapons, he instructed security to take down metal detectors and let the mob in.
I was in the vicinity of a conversation where I overheard the president say something to the effect of, "You know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in. Take the effing mags away."
Yeah. Apparently, Trump wanted the metal detectors removed so that his supporters with guns could march to the Capitol. Yeah. So I guess he didn't necessarily want to hang Mike Pence. He wanted to also give him the option of a firing squad. So he's pro-choice. This is good to know. It's good to know. All right, that's it for the headlines. But before we go take a break, let's check in on the stock market with our finance expert, Michael Costa, everybody! It is a crazy, crazy time in the markets, yeah. Man. What's going on in the market today?
Well, I am crushing the market. I mean, I just keep crushing.
I
keep making so much money. And I have a hot tip for you and a hot tip for you how you can crush it in the market as well. So, first, though, Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah.
You know, I feel bad for him. I do. Because, look, if you haven't been touched in a long time, just the littlest contact, it feels like your whole world has moved, you know? And look, I've had some epic dry spells in my life. I mean, I remember there were years where... No, do you want to... We get to the charts real quick.
You, you can tell the story.
Okay, so look, let's
oh,
get.
Oh, you don't
want to
tell the story?
Let's get to the mortgage rates, Trevor. Yeah, I think. Okay. Sorry, I kind of trailed off there. Look, the interest in mortgage is going way up. Okay, and if you're looking to buy a house right now, this is really scaring you. And people are asking why. Why did they start so low and they're going high now? Well, I'm an expert. Let me break it down for you. That's why you invite me here.
Yeah, know? Definitely.
Right. So look, in January, interest on mortgage it was low. It's cold, right? We have seasonal depression. We don't have any money left from the holidays. I mean, I even tried to call my realtor, but the mittens I was wearing were so big, I couldn't even, you know, get her phone number right. So look, now the sun comes out, right? Seasons change. Hey, I'm kind of interested in having a backyard. I'm kind of interested in having a pool. I'm kind of interested in having an open concept outdoor kitchen, right? Now I can flip burgers while I'm talking to my friends as they're swimming in the pool. That's why, Trevor, right now, end of June, interest is at its highest.
Michael, I don't think that that's correct.
Look, here's the long and short of it, okay? These are the three numbers you want to pay attention to. This right here is the 30-year fixed rate mortgage. 30 years? Who's planning that far ahead? 30 years? I don't even know if I have clean underwear to wear tomorrow, okay? I certainly didn't have it today, and I now am supposed to plan 30 years from now? That's a long time. 15 years, you know, it's not much better. This is the one you want, Trevor, okay? This is the adjustable rate mortgage. This is one you want, but it's competitive and it's tough. And here's how you get it, okay? You have to pool your money with 5 1-year-olds, okay? Now, who even knows 1 1-year-old, right? And even if you secure a meeting, how do you communicate with that 1-year-old? So that's a tough one to get, but you can do it. Hot tip. I promised you a hot tip,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
okay, look,
tip.
If you're closing on a house anytime soon and you are unhappy with your mortgage rate, every piece of paper you sign, all you gotta do is just date it back here. The bank has to honor it. That's your hot tip.
Starting to wonder about your expertise. Michael Costa, everybody. All right, don't go away. When we come back, we'll be talking to New York City Mayor Eric Adams. You don't want to miss it.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings early and ad-free starting May 1st with a 48 Hours Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Daily Show. My guest tonight is the mayor of New York City. He's joining me to discuss his first 6 months in office and how he's tackling some of the city's most pressing issues. Please welcome Mayor Eric Adams.
You don't realize it, but you just assaulted me with that handshake.
I'll try and be a little more gentle next
please,
time.
Please, please.
I'll try and be a little more gentle.
No,
welcome
please.
To the show.
Thank you, because you know, you doing that, you could be inside for 24 hours, you know?
Let's talk about that before we move on. Like, I heard what you said about Rudy Giuliani. You said that he should actually be investigated for reporting a false crime because if it wasn't for that video footage, that person who tapped him on the back, which, again, I don't condone, but that wasn't assault.
No, it was not. And you know, we are joking about it, but think about this for a moment. There was a woman called, we called her Karen, brother told her to put a dog on her leash.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
She said to the DA, listen, that's a false, she falsely reported a crime. She needs to be arrested. He falsely reported a crime. And the district attorney should take that seriously. That person that he falsely reported spent 24 hours in jail. That's not acceptable. It's not acceptable. And so I'm going to call the DA. We must be consistent. All of that theatrics that he did, that's not acceptable. If that tape wasn't there, imagine what would have happened to that man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can't happen. Can't happen.
Well, you're the man. You can make those calls.
And you know what's interesting? What's interesting is that when you saw the testimony in Washington, he has some other things he has to deal with as well.
We definitely saw that. But let's talk about you, man. We don't give it all to him. You have now been in office for, was it 6 months now officially?
Hard to believe. You know, when you're the mayor of New York, it's like a dog day. Every day is 14.
It is one of the hardest jobs in the world. It's also one of the most thankless jobs in the world. You've had your ups, you've had your downs. Let's talk about some of the things people have commended you on. Mm. Many New Yorkers have really been impressed by the attitude you've taken to education. You know, you've come in, you've revamped the system. You're creating a world where, you know, your staff is really focusing on getting New York City's education up to where it needs to be. Two parts to the question. Number one, what do you still think needs to be achieved in terms of education in New York? And number two, how do you remove or fight against all of the segregation that happens in New York City schools? Because you have a city where everyone mixes, and yet in the schools, it seems like the city is still in Jim Crow.
You know, a couple of things. Number one, I learned a lot when I was in South Africa. I drove from Cape Town to Port Elizabeth to Joburg, and I spoke to a lot of people there. When people talk about segregation, they don't look at the hidden segregation we have in America.
Right.
Our school system is dysfunctional. And we have acknowledged that dysfunctionality because black and brown and poorer students are the impact of that. 65% of black and brown children never reach proficiency in our New York City school system.
Wow.
And we've normalized that. And so what I did, I looked at my journey. I was dyslexic. I'm dyslexic. From K through 12, I used to walk in the school building. They used to put dumb suited on the chair. I was bullied. And then not until I got into high school did I discover I was dyslexic. There was nothing wrong with me.
Wow.
30 to 40% of the prisoners that are in Rikers Island, dyslexic. So what am I doing as mayor? I'm taking my journey and now helping other children. We have dyslexia screening for every child now, and I'm going to Rikers and screen the prisoners for dyslexia so they can get the services they need.
You've also been commended on your views on gentrification. You know, one thing that makes New York one of the greatest cities in the world is how many people are in it. It's a melting pot. Unfortunately, it looks like, you know, certain colors are melting out of that pot right now.
Without a doubt.
And being priced out of their neighborhoods. On Juneteenth, you gave a really impassioned speech where you said, in some ways, gentrification feels to you like a legacy of slavery. How do you fight gentrification? How do you create a world where people can move, can sell their places, but the city doesn't create an environment where poor and brown and black people are kicked out of their neighborhoods, essentially?
I love that. I love that question because people really miss when you start engaging in gentrification, people start to just close up and start to get angry. Now we divide the lines. No. When you go back, when I was a sergeant in the police department, a black woman moved into a place called Garrison Beach, and they tore up her house. They destroyed her house. I went out there with a group of 100 blacks in law enforcement, black police officers, and said, we're going to sleep in this house, and we dare you to come and try to throw us out. Why do I say that? Because gentrification is not an ethnicity. It's a mindset. When you move into a community and all of a sudden you let your dog crap on somebody's yard and won't pick it up and you ignore the people, you won't go into the stores that are there already, and you want to arrest someone for playing dominoes, or, hey, somebody double parks in front of this block and we hear loud noises coming out. That's a church. And that church was there before you got there. So instead of treating communities as though they're not there, you didn't discover Brooklyn. You didn't discover Harlem. Come be a part of the communities and bring your flair, bring your character. That's how you merge together.
On the ground, though, how do you make that happen? Because it's a complicated issue in that there are many homeowners in Harlem, in Brooklyn, et cetera, where I feel like they're trapped in a loop
where they're destined to fail. There are people who own their homes. The homes aren't given the valuations that they deserve because they're black families living in a quote-unquote black neighborhood, or because, you know, it's Latino families living in a quote-unquote Latino neighborhood, and they don't get the valuations, they don't get the services. People say your home isn't worth much. Somebody comes in with a lot of money, they buy the place for pennies on the dollar. The more people do that, the more the values go up, the more the services go up, and now they've made a windfall on that. So how do you actually affect that on the ground beyond just saying to the people, don't move here and you know, erase who's here? How do you help people with actual policy?
Well, number one, we have to get back in the business of home ownership. And we've moved away from that. We used to have something called Mitchellamas. I brought my first home in Bed-Stuy. Some people like to think I live in Jersey, but I live in Brooklyn. You know, I brought my first home in Bed-Stuy, and it was through a program, a federal program. They had a program called Officer and Teacher Next Door Program, because they felt as though if you brought professionals into communities, you will help that entire block. I started a block patrol, my first co-op. I bought it in Prospect Heights. No one wanted to live there. When I got there, I started a patrol of the block. We started programs with the people there. So black and brown communities, they want the same things. No matter a Latino community, mm-hmm. they want the mm-hmm. same things with whatever community. What we have done in this city and in this country, we wait until communities are gentrified before we bring the services into the community. And I say no to that. You know, because you are the person that drives the limousine, you want the same thing as the person that sits in the back of the limousine, and you deserve the same thing, and that's what we have to do.
I'm going to chat to you a little bit more after the break. We're going to be chatting about police, we're going to be chatting about rents in the city, and we'll be chatting about why some people think you're the quirkiest, most interesting mayor in America. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more from Mayor Adams.
I'm Jonquilin Hill, host of The Weeds. And I know that politics can feel like a joke, and not always in the ha-ha funny way. On The Weeds, we try to split the difference.
When you think run out of money, you think that we're going to get to a point where, like, one guy retires and Social Security is like, sorry, y'all, got to board up.
Like that's it. Sorry, he got the last check.
I always call him Jim. Like, Jim got it. Sorry, y'all. He got the last check, and that's all the checks we got, and Social Security is no more.
Check out The Weeds every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
To The Daily Show, where we are joined by New York City Mayor Eric Adams. Mayor Adams, let's jump into some of the most pressing issues in the city. Number one, police, which touches on crime, but you know, it's almost two separate issues at the same time. One of the things you ran on coming into office was, I'm going to bring down crime in New York City. Since you've come into office, crime has skyrocketed. You know, it's only been 5-6 months, but I'm sure many people would love to know from your perspective, how long do you think that promise will take to achieve? And how do you actually bring crime down? Because every mayor has a different solution for actually achieving that.
Well, it's a unique moment. You know, people that know my history, I was arrested at 15. I was beat badly by police officers. They assaulted my brother and I in the 103rd precinct. I returned back to that precinct when I became the mayor. I fought against the abuse of stop and frisk. I've testified in federal court. And the judge mentioned my testimony when she ruled against the police department. I can't go backwards. We can't go back to the days when every black and brown child that walked the streets was treated unfairly. And so we have to have that balance. I like to say intervention and prevention. Intervention is right now. We took 3,000 guns off our street. Shootings dropped by 30%. Homicide dropped by 13%. We're moving in the right way, but I'm not going to allow us to be abusive in the process. Prevention, let's do the long-term things. Let's lean into foster care children so they have the opportunities and not age out without the support. Let's do the dyslexia screening. Let's go into how we educate our children, because if you don't educate, you will incarcerate. And we're feeding the criminal justice system, and no one cares. Archbishop Desmond Tutu from South Africa said, we spend a lifetime pulling people out of the river. No one goes upstream and prevent them from falling in the first place. We're pushing people into the river. And when you look downstream, you know who you're pulling out? You're pulling out the Eric Adams that are dyslexic. You're pulling out the foster care children. black and brown children are falling in the river every day, and you have a mayor that has been in that river, and now I'm going upstream to prevent them from falling in the river.
You also have to balance that with how people feel in the city, you
Definitely,
know?
Yes.
One of the hardest things about being a mayor, I can only assume, is that you're dealing with the reality and you're dealing with the feeling.
Yes,
you know, I remember
yes.
one of the first things that shocked me when I moved to New York was how much the local news terrifies you.
Right.
Every night, they'd
right.
be like, watch out, someone's punching people in the street.
Right.
And it makes it seem like everything's
right.
happening everywhere. And yes, there are real crimes
yes.
being committed, but it's not as panicked as people make it seem.
And I'm loving that. Last week we had about 3.5 million people that rode the train in a day. We have about 6 crimes on the subway per day. About 6 per day, those 3.5.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to deal with what you felt and then move to what you are feeling. And that takes some time before what you felt and what you're feeling. So what does that look like? When we started out our homeless encampment on the subway system, my first month in office, I went and visited people that lived in camps and tents on the street.
Mm-hmm.
I saw human waste, drug paraphernalia. I said, people can't live like this. And so we did a program in our subway system. The first week, 22 people took us up on an offer to go into our shelter system. Right now, 1,700 are no longer living on the subway system, and they're getting the services they deserve.
But how do you deal with a situation where, you know, it's sensitive? And what I don't like sometimes in America is people make it seem like these issues are easy. There's,
right.
there's no denying that in New York, the homeless issue cannot be separated from mental health issues.
Without
you
a
know,
doubt.
If you walk through the
Without
streets, you see it.
Right.
So how do you find a humane way to deal with people who, quote unquote, maybe want to live on the streets, but clearly cannot survive on the streets? And then you're the mayor who's taking the people off the streets and saying, I think this is better for them. And they're saying, no, this isn't. How do you find that balance?
Right. And so when I went into those tents in those cardboard boxes late at night during the winter month, and I spoke to homeless, and I realized that, hey, this person is bipolar. There are people living on the street that can't make the decisions for themselves. And so everyone is advocating, saying they should have the decency to live on the street. There's nothing decent about that. And I'm a Christian. If Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John was around right now, they'd be with me in the streets helping homeless people and not being removed or distanced from that. My programs are on the ground. I'm not afraid to be on the ground. I'm not afraid to make the mistake, man. I'm perfectly imperfect. You know, I'm doing my job mm-hmm. of turning around a city that has denied people for so long. I know that denial. I lived there. I watched mommy work 3 jobs to take care of 6 children, and then they gave her food that caused her to have heart disease, diabetes. I was diabetic. I woke up one morning, I couldn't see. The doctor said, Eric, you're going to be blind in a year. You're going to lose some fingers and toes. I went to see doctors that told me, it's your food, it's not your DNA, it's your dinner. When I changed my diet, within 3 weeks, my sight came back. My nerve damage went away. I lost 35 pounds, 35 pounds.
You look it.
Yeah.
You look it. So what you're saying, if I understand correctly, is you're trying to find the balance in a world where it's really difficult. Like, so do you have teams that are specifically tasked with helping homeless people who are struggling
yes,
with mental
yes.
health issues?
Unbelievable combination. My team that I put together is extremely impressive. And we are on the ground talking to people and bringing them to a place where they ought to be. I can't meet people where I am. I have to go where they are and
mm-hmm.
take them where they ought to be. And you're going to look over this journey and people see the unorthodox way that I move. I don't fit the model. You know, this boy
right,
head
right.
cat with an earring, you know, he went to hang out at Zero Bond or at some other club. Listen, I'm New York. And New York has this energy and spirit to it. This is a unique place. It's not our Empire State Building. It's not the Statue of Liberty. We are who we are because, as Apple soft drink owner said, we're made up of the best stuff on earth. We're New Yorkers.
Let me ask you this then about New York. This city has always been an interesting place where the police unions and the mayors have often had a fraught relationship. You're a really unique mayor in that you were police, you come from police, and yet you've experienced police, and you've tried to change police, and yet at the same time, you have to encourage the police. So obviously you have critics and fans that inhabit both spaces.
Right,
but
right.
I'd love to know this, because I know a lot of New Yorkers have this as a question. When crime is down in the city, mayors will say, well, that means the police are doing their job. We need to give them more money, more funding to the police force. which oftentimes means less funding for the schools, the other services, et cetera, et cetera. But then when crime is up in the city, mayors will say, oh, that means we need to give the police more money because they need more help bringing the crime down. So what I'd like to understand is, why is it that in that job, whether things are going well or not going well, the money always increases? It doesn't seem like it matches what's happening in the city. And how do you address that as mayor whilst also acknowledging these are people in the city trying to keep everybody safe, et cetera, from a mayor's perspective. I understand it.
Right.
How do you find that balance?
Good question. Well, first of all, the prerequisite to prosperity is public safety and justice. They go together. Historically, people will say you could only have justice, you could only have public safety. And I say no to that. It's not a trade-off. We could have both. We could be safe and we could have justice. That accountability is going to be in place. But let's not kid ourselves. We have been producing an inferior product all across the city. We spend $38 billion a year on education. Yet 65% of black and brown children never reach education. Mm-hmm. They've been playing us. We've been getting played for so long. So the problem is not that people dislike me. They says they you know who dislike me? People who have been eating off of us. All of those people who make contracts from pulling people downstream, you know how much money is made when a child is dyslexic and is not educated and he's incarcerated? You have counselors, you have therapists, you know, you have people who feed them prescription and drugs. People have been playing us, brother, for a long time. And now I come along and say, listen, the gig is up, you know?
That's interesting. So have you found that you're getting a lot of resistance from people? Have you found that you've been getting a lot of resistance from people who feel like you're shaking things up a little too much? Because that's something any New Yorker knows, as you know, especially if you're born here. But when you live here after a while, you realize everything feels like somebody's running something, whether it's the MTA or, you know, when you're driving across a bridge, you can feel power dynamics shift, etc. How do you then find that balance without being sabotaged then?
Well, you have to be, first of all, you have to ignore the noise. We have 8.8 million New Yorkers and 33 different opinions. There's only one mayor that's going to make the decisions. Right now, I'm the mayor, and I'm going to make the decisions for the next 4 years mm-hmm. to move this city in the right direction. So there's so much noise out there. And when you go after that institutional dollars that have been feeding and eating off this system, why do you think I'm under attack all the time? Why do you think they write all these stories about Eric Adams? Because Eric Adams is going at the heart. Eric is taking the city upstream. And we're not spending all that money downstream. And that is, I'm going after the foundation of people who have been eating off of the dysfunctionality of our communities for years.
So just in case I missed it though, I don't think I did, but how do you then grade whether the police are doing well or not in your city?
Combination, because we'll never be able to deal with this crime problem with just police.
Okay.
We can't police our way out of this. When you have foster care children that age out at 21, mm-hmm. and you know every year 6,700 of them are, only 5% graduate from high school, only 22% graduate from high school, 5% from college. They're more likely to be homeless, mental health, unemployed, victims of crime, participate in crime. So what I'm saying, no, let's let them get support until they're 26, 90% graduate from high school. Let's open up our trade schools like I did at the Brooklyn STEAM Center and give these children certifications. Let them go into some of these jobs. Google is here, Facebook is here. Mm-hmm. Why not have these children fed right into employment, be part of the growth of the city? So if you employ, then you won't have to worry about the criminality that you're seeing. By the time a child picks up a gun, we already failed. We failed already.
But then why do you care so much about some of the smaller things? You know, like for instance, why does the city need to spend so much money on police monitoring who jumps a fare and who doesn't? Like, what is the percentage of money that a city's losing on fare jumping?
I like that.
Do people really need to
question.
Go to jail for, like, come on, people are going to pay. And the people who don't pay, like, what is that percentage versus everyone else?
That's a great question. Here's what we can't do. We cannot send a message that any and everything goes in our city. Because it starts with, okay, so what, someone jumps the fare. And when there are systems, we have a reduced fare MetroCard program. But if you can't pay enough, we're going to give you the MetroCard. And there's ways to get on the system if you can't pay. So you can't walk into Duane Reade and say, you know what? I'm going to take whatever I want off the shelf and I'm going to walk out. Because now Duane Reade is going to close down, and that low-wage employee who's going to school at night to try to make a living is going to lose his job because you decided you don't want to pay. So we can't have a city where you can do whatever you want. No. We're going to be a city, we're not going to criminalize poor, but we're not going to allow someone to state that their economic status is going to allow them to disrespect what it is to live in a city like New York. I know what it is to be poor, brother. We used to go to school every day with a garbage bag full of clothing because mommy said we're going to be thrown out and we want you to have clean clothing so you won't be embarrassed when you go to school. But mommy made sure we're going to always uplift ourselves, fight hard, and we're going to be respectful in the process. I'm not going to allow people to believe because of where they are is who they are. We're so much better.
So let's talk about one of the parts of the city that everyone agrees needs to become better, and that is affordability.
Yes.
As you said, New York City is not made by the Empire State Building. It's not made by the Statue of Liberty. It's made by the people.
Yes.
The people feel like they can't remain in New York because they can't afford to live here. And you're seeing this spread. It's going out to Brooklyn, it's spreading into Harlem, many parts. I mean, the main part of the island is almost unaffordable for most people. For people who don't live in rent-controlled apartments, where there's no recourse, I've heard people's rents jump by 20%, 30%, 40%. It can just do whatever, and you're out. Mm-hmm. Your life has changed. It becomes unaffordable. Half the places in Midtown are owned by people who don't even live in the city, never mind the country. What do you do as mayor to prevent that from happening? How do you make it so that the people actually want to live in the city? Because I've seen you say, by the way, people need to come back to the office. I've seen you say, we need to get back in the office. People need to get, you know, the New York City back to life. And I understand why. Right. Mm-hmm. But I can also see why people say, well, Mayor Adams, why should I come back to the city when I can go and live, you know, 40 minutes away, 50 minutes away in Connecticut on a train and not have to pay these rents anymore? How do you prevent these people from turning this into a ghost town?
Yeah, very, very. It's a good question. First of all, charity begins at home. I have a small three-family house. My tenants, when they moved in several years ago, 15, 16 years ago, I had them sign a lease that as long as you live in my apartments, you'll never have your rent increased at all. And they've been there, and they've never had a rent increase.
Never?
Never, never. Wow. From the time that they moved in, the audience is saying, where do you live so I can move in, you know? But because there's so much for human need, there's just not a lot for human greed. Gandhi said that.
Yeah, but what do you do?
And so
what, do you
what do? I must do as the mayor is now create affordable housing, which we're doing, and which is very interesting. You have some of the people who are advocating for affordable housing, and I say, okay, great. We're going to build it on your block. Whoa, not on my block.
Right, right.
you want to upzone on my block?
Yes.
See, we have to stop the hypocrisy of people, those who are advocating for something, but when it's time to produce it in their space, inconvenience them, now they have a whole nother conversation. We want to build safe haven beds. Show me the community that's going to allow me to build the safe haven beds to get wraparound services. So we must get in the business of affordable housing. Mm-hmm. But once we build it, we have to put people in the units. We've had almost 2,200 units that were empty because we didn't have a system in place that is the dysfunctionality of we were just counting how many units we have. But hey, how many people did you put in those units?
Right.
We're moving in another direction. Then we do a NYCHA. We got NYCHA Land Trust. Everybody tried to do what we're doing now with NYCHA Land Trust. Almost 400,000 people that were living in substandard conditions. Now we have a land trust where they're going to be able to pick the contractors. They're going to have a voice in picking the contractors. They're going to have a voice in voting on the land trust. Mm-hmm. We're going to change the game of NYCHA, which you know what NYCHA residents have been going through for years. And now we're moving in another direction. So the affordability is crucial.
Do you think you can find the balance? Because as a mayor, you're always responding to business, some of the richest people in the city.
Yes.
You know, you're responding to the people who are annoyed by poor people. As you said, the NIMBYs, not in my backyard. Right. They want change, but not in their backyard. And you're responding to the majority of the 8 million people.
Yes.
What do you think you're going to be able to do in the short term? I understand the ideas behind it, but what's a concrete thing you can say to New Yorkers where you go like, hey, this is what I'm actually going to do for you in the short term?
Right, and we're doing that right now. First of all, the affluent New Yorkers. Do you know 52% of our taxes are paid by 2% of New Yorkers.
I can believe that.
If we lose those 2%, we lose our teachers, our firefighters, our cops. So for me not to engage those high income earners, that's a foolish as a mayor. And I'm not going to do that. I want them to pay their taxes. I want them to volunteer. I want them to contribute to my museums, to my nonprofits. They need to be a part of that. And so when you look at what we're doing right away, child care vouchers for the families in the city, you know, people are paying $50 a week. We were able to get them down to $10 a week. We're opening so many new seats in child care. What we're doing with dyslexia screening, what we're doing with college fund for our children. When you start out a college fund for a child, they're four times more likely to go to college by having that this college fund.
Right.
When you look at what we're doing, what's called the crisis management team, and how they deal with crisis on the ground for prevention.
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing with earned income tax credit. Brother, we send back billions of dollars because people don't know how to fill out the forms to get the resources that they deserve. So we're making it that easier and streamlining the earned income tax credit. Mm-hmm. So we're doing things that are going to put money back in the pockets of New Yorkers. Then we're going to empower them on how job readiness, how to be part of the city as it builds up. Cities that are built up and futures of people going down is unacceptable in this administration. And you're going to see visible results in this city.
So before I let you go, I'd love to know real quick, what would you grade yourself as a mayor right now? What grade would you give yourself? And I know it's a tough one.
I told you when we spoke earlier, there's no tough questions for me because I'm authentic. Okay. Right. I'm going to be me.
You are you, definitely. I'll say that about you. What would you grade yourself as a mayor?
I'm incomplete.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's an interesting one.
I'm incomplete.
All right.
I'm incomplete as a mayor. I'm incomplete as a man. I'm incomplete as a father.
Uh-huh.
I'm incomplete, complete in my personal life. I get up every morning. I meditate. I exercise. I pray. I say the Pledge of Allegiance. And I get myself ready.
Every day?
Every day. Every day.
I mean, the last one's a bit weird, every you have day. To admit.
Well, but it's not. It's not when you think.
I mean, surely the flag knows by now that you, I mean.
Yeah, well, you know, this country has a lot of issues.
Yes, it does.
But I've been all over the globe. And this is the only country where dream is attached to our name. There's not a German dream, a French dream.
Well, the French dream is, but it's a very different kind of dream. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about you as a human being for a moment. Something that has really intrigued people about you is who you are, as you say. You know, the earring wearing, you know, vegetarian but fish eating, late night going out. I mean, we've seen pictures of you with rappers, with models, you know, partying, having a good time, still getting out. You don't seem afraid to be who you are and do what you're doing and not have that negatively impact the idea of your job as a mayor. Are you worried at all about image, or do you think it's all just got to be about what you actually do on the ground?
Listen. I'm a real believer that I believe in quantum physics. I believe you create your reality. I put in the universe almost 30 years ago that in 2022 I was going to be mayor, and every place I traveled to, I told people I'm going to be mayor. People look back over the records and me speaking back when I was a captain, when I was a state senator, when I was a borough president, they heard me say I'm gonna be mayor in 2022. People don't reach their reality because they don't believe in the power of what they say. And so the universe knows I'm contributing to the universe. The universe is going to make sure that I'm all right. I'm going to be all right. How people judge me, that's up to them. I like Eric. And I had an amazing, amazing mother that told me when I went on the stage to speak as a child and I was nervous, mommy leaned over and whispered in my ear, baby, you got this. And she transitioned last year. But every time I'm out here, I still hear mommy whispering in my ear, baby, you got this. Huh. And I'm saying to New Yorkers, we got this, New York. Don't even worry about it.
Thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate the time. I know you're a busy man. I hope to have you back.
We'll talk about this every few years. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.
Dana Carvey and David Spade here.
You might know our podcast, Fly on the Wall, featuring guests from across the entertainment industry.
We decided to do a spinoff called Superfly, and it's fun. It's just two of us riffing on current events, pop culture, catching up, impressions.
Joe, Trump's trying to be a dictator. Yeah, she says, bump on the tater tots. Joe, no.
Listen to and follow Superfly on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcast.
Well, that's our show for tonight. But before we go, if you or someone you know needs help accessing abortion care, go to abortionfinder.org or call the National Abortion Hotline at the number below. You still have options. Until next time, stay safe out there. And remember, live every day like someone might touch you on the back.
Watch The Daily Show weeknights at 11, 10 Central on Comedy Central. And stream full episodes anytime on Paramount Plus.
This has been a Comedy Central podcast.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, early and ad-free, starting May 1st with a 48 Hours Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts.